restrain yourselves. Thank you so much, and thank you for a very kind welcome today. And if I may say so, thank you for the service this morning. It was wonderful to be able to join in with all of you. When I was approached by Dan several months ago about this program, he asked whether I would be interested in coming and interested in introducing Kevin. And I responded immediately to say that I would be delighted to come and introduce Kevin Page because, like many of you, I have admired the way he has done his job on behalf of Canadians and on behalf of Parliament over the last several years. I think that I'm certainly going to allow Kevin to speak on his own behalf, but I think that it would be fair to say that someone who spent most of his life in public service would find it rather extraordinary to be placed in the middle of such commentary and conflict and controversy in which Mr. Page, by virtue of him doing his job, found himself. We didn't always have a parliamentary budget officer. It's a relatively recent creation. It was a suggestion that was made by the party that is now in government as a way of giving Parliament the best possible information with which to deal with the accounts of the Government of Canada. And I think that when the Conservatives realized what they had done in creating the office, they quickly began to try to undermine the work of Kevin and his very proficient staff. I just want to say that this is absolutely not about partisanship. I have no idea what Mr. Page's politics are. I don't even know him very well. We've met a couple of times. But I can only say that as a member of Parliament, who sometimes made inquiries to the staff of the Parliamentary Budget Office, I was always taken aback by how willing they were to provide information and to give a sense of direction to an MP as to where you might find alternative information. And as time went on, I talked about it with my colleagues, and they had exactly the same experience, that it was a good, positive experience in trying to get information and trying to find out what these numbers might mean or what other numbers might be available. Mr. Page found himself in the middle of a conflict that had to do with his doing his job and the government of the day objecting strongly to the fact that he was doing his job. I think a great many Canadians and a great many parliamentarians and a great many members of the Conservative Party caucus felt very grateful for Kevin's courage and also grateful for his willingness to simply do his job in the face of a lot of attack. I will refrain from making any other comment that might be perceived as being critical of the government of the day, except to say that I think their conduct in regard to the way Mr. Page did his job was disgraceful, and I feel that very strongly. And I think this view is widely shared across the country, and certainly by a number of commentators and people who follow these events and who are concerned about them as they relate to how government does its work. But whether it was the now infamous saga of the F-35 fighter purchase or proposed purchase, looking at issues of how governments are doing their job and how the government plan to proceed in one area or another, Mr. Page's responses were always well-researched, well-thought-out, well-presented, and challenging to a status quo that often does not want to reveal everything it knows and all of its numbers and figures. And in the F-35 controversy, about which I was very much involved as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, I can tell you that we were all very impressed with this one simple fact, and that is, as time went on, it was Mr. Page's numbers that were that held up under scrutiny, and the government's numbers that did not hold up under scrutiny. Having said that, I think that no other area has Mr. Page been more compelling and forthright than in insisting that Canadians understand the particular challenge that we face in the whole criminal justice area. We have only to look south of the border to understand the impact that a generation of policies can have on a country. And in fact, in the United States, there are a great many conservative senators and congressmen who now are being forced to come to grips with the implications of what they have done. The highest levels of incarceration anywhere in the world, and no drop in the rate of crime or increase in levels of public safety and public security. So I think all of us in Parliament have been very much affected by this debate and this discussion. I wish I could say that all political parties, or indeed any political party, showed the same level of toughness and courage that Mr. Page and his group have done in simply asking Canadians to have a look at what the cost of minimum sentencing really is, at what the cost of increased incarceration really is, and the fact that these costs in our federal system are being borne both by the federal government and by the province. So this opportunity to introduce Mr. Page was really a chance for me to say, as a parliamentarian and as a Canadian, that Kevin Page's work was quite simply exemplary, that his courage has been outstanding, and that his sense of public service is appreciated by many, many people across the country. And I hope that he realizes and understands that, and also realizes that there were many moments when I would have liked to have been able to reach out a very public hand in saying these things, but that I knew perfectly well that were I to do so, it would only make Mr. Page's demise even quicker than it turned out to be. So in my wisdom, I decided to simply indicate to all and sundry who knew Mr. Page how much many, many people in Canada appreciated what he was doing and looked forward to the opportunity when I could make a confession. And I can think of few better places to do so than in the sanctuary of this church. So for my silence, I ask to be forgiven, but for the support that you've given to all of us, we're very, very appreciative. And no further more from me. The stage goes to Mr. Page. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And, wow, just a few thank yous, and I'd like to talk about a few issues. And first, thank you to Dan for making this event possible. What a great title, The Criminal Justice System for Our Just Society, and for bringing us all together. And again, this is a series of talks now, so I feel like I'm part of something that's it's much bigger than maybe all of us. And thank you, Dan, for that. And then certainly just a thanks to Mr. Ray, who I've admired for many years, both as a leader and as a role model. Now I can say this because I'm no longer the Parliamentary Budget Officer. Yeah, I mean, just for his incredible competence, for his grace, and for his compassion. And that just comes through with the issues that he's dealing with now for the Aboriginal community, but throughout his whole career. And I could honestly say, you know, I look at Mr. Ray as being one of the great political leaders of my life. And so thank you, Mr. Ray. Just a little story. I still remember, you know, how life, you always remember these little moments, and they keep coming back, and usually you know, crazy times. I still remember walking into a public accounts meeting, and it was on the F-35 issue that Mr. Ray's mentioned, and that Bob raised. And I remember walking into the room, and there's lots of people there. This was after the Auditor General released on his report, Mr. Ferguson released his report on the costs and kind of put our PBO numbers in better perspective and relative to the governments. And, you know, usually there's all kinds of, people are lined up on one side, which was the Conservative Party members were lined up on one side. And then I looked to the other side and I saw Mr. Ray there. And I remember saying to some of my colleagues, like, this is a big deal. This is, to have Mr. Ray at the table. And just and to thank you all for showing up, and because this is so important, not just for Mr. Lang and for others, but for all you people, because I know you believe in a just society and the importance of a criminal justice system. So I have three topics. Obviously, I'm going to talk about the costs of the criminal justice system, but first, just a few remarks on the state of our democratic institutions. And then secondly, just a few words, not many words, on the Parliamentary Budget Office, what we're trying to do, so you can kind of understand when we get to the costs, what we did and what we did not do, in terms of kind of costing the criminal justice system. So first, on the state of our democratic institutions, it'd be easy to talk about the Senate, but I'm not going to start there. Maybe, we'll end there, I don't know. But there's a very famous politician from the United Kingdom, William Gladstone, in 1881, talked about the control of the public purse. This is a fellow that was Prime Minister of the United Kingdom multiple times, I think four times. He served as like their version of the finance minister, served both in opposition and had power. And he said this, and I love this quote. If the House of Commons, by any possibility, loses the power of the purse of the grants of public money, depend on it, your very liberty will be worth very little by comparison. Of all the things I've come across, looking at history, reading these big fat books on procedures of House of Commons, that one quote that kind of says like how important that power of the purse is and why it needs to rest in the hands of individual MPs and not just in the Prime Minister's office. And I thought it's very, very, very powerful words. And again, from a person that's been on both sides of the fence with respect to power. And from my point of view, and I say this very honestly, that I think the House of Commons has lost, that control of the public purse. So his words seem very prescient, 100 years later, more than 100 years later. I think, our system is broken. The system that MPs, that they use to approve, expenditures, that they approve changes in tax legislation. To be honest, it was designed to be confusing for them so that they don't understand it. And I know that because I was one of the designers. I think the MPs, they have the power of the purse in theory, but not in practice. And again, this is a power of the purse that goes all the way back to the days of Magna Carta, the days of kings and queens, where we say we want, individual elected MPs, that are not part of the executive, to hold the executive to account, which is a very important role. Another quote from another person, almost the same era, John Stuart Mill. He said, on the art of manipulation, John Stuart Mill, a kind of an English philosopher, also somebody that economists have to read too when I was in school. It is not the violent conflict between the parts of the truth. He said, it is not the violent conflict between the parts of the truth, but the quiet suppression of half of it is the formidable evil. So this issue of movement of information so that MPs can debate policies and hold executives to account. And, as an economist, somebody that studied, supply and demand, those simple curves, one of the key aspects is something they call information asymmetry. And if one side has all the information on making decisions and doesn't share it, the system becomes very imbalanced. And right now, the executive, Cabinet, the Prime Minister, they have all that information. The public service has that information. I know because for 27 years, I worked in all those central agencies, with all that information at my disposal. And they control it to suit their needs, which isn't effectively, it isn't to, make accountability stronger. In fact, it's usually quite the opposite. It's to get from A to B as fast as possible, to get a decision implemented. Whether it's right or wrong, and from an ethical standpoint. Okay, the last quote, I promise. Leo Tolstoy, famous writer, also kind of same time, 1800s, on human behavior. Leo Tolstoy said, there is no conditions of life, there are no conditions of life to which a man cannot get accustomed. especially if he sees them accepted by everyone around him. There is no conditions of life to which a man can get or woman can get accustomed, especially if he or she sees them accepted by everyone around them. And to me, it's a line, it's an old line, but it just tells us, like, when you look at what's going on in the Senate right now, or when we found ourselves in these files as the Parliamentary Budget Officer, when we'd be debating the cost of the wars, we costed Aboriginal educational infrastructure. We could have improved the way we do that for Aboriginal people. Or, you know, or changes to old age security or crime bills. It's like, and we'd be out there saying we need to get this information in front of Parliament. There are costs to these things. There may be benefits as well, but there are costs. And then, you know, there was a long period of time where it felt like nobody was listening. And everybody said, they would use these lines, well, this is normal. Like, and what you, and then they would look to me and say, well, you're the person that's not normal here. And so, again, as other people call it willful blindness. Like, when you have these big decisions in life and you don't really want to face the facts and you stick your head in the sand. And you could do that on the criminal justice system as well. And so I think we have a bad case of willful blindness, I would argue. I think what happens to these institutions, what's happening in the Senate right now is not good because it prevents us from dealing with the big policy issues of the day, which, you know, thanks to Dan, you know, and this speaker series that people get to talk about. So for me, this democratic deficit, this weakness in our institutions, it's growing. And ironically, it's growing at the same time as our deficit. Our fiscal deficit is declining. And they're both important. And I would argue that the democratic deficit is more important. And I argue that as the budget officer. So, like, we're dealing, and we all know this, we're dealing with a declining turnout, at elections times. We're dealing with, with massive cynicism that just gets worse because of the way we watch TV right now. And I think it affects both the political leaders, which we want to aspire to, because, you know, I want to teach students at the University of Ottawa that are going to become future Bob Rays. And it gets difficult when they say, well, what's in it? You know, it's so hard to be a Bob Ray, and the rest of it just doesn't look right to them. And there's also a lot of cynicism directed towards public servants in this environment. There's a line by Tony Judd that I like. He says, in the short run, Tony Judd was a great, he passed away not that long ago, but a great British historian, philosopher. He says, in the short run, democracies can survive the indifference of citizens. In the short run, democracies, you could survive the indifferences of citizens. But in the long run, Mr. Judd said, democracies exist only by the virtue of the engagement of citizens in the management of public affairs. So that's, it's this kind of group coming together. This is democracy. And that, you know, your willingness to vote in elections, your willingness to support Mr. Ray, as you had for many decades, is democracy and getting involved in the management of public affairs. So again, the stakes are big for me, and I think for Canada. These institutions, we're downgrading our institutions. And I would argue it almost looks purposeful to me. So I see what's going on in the Senate, and I say, is this part of a plan? Like, we really want to undermine these institutions at this point that nobody really cares. Make government smaller, make government less effective. Is this the plan? Because I think the majority are disillusioned now. And there's a lot of research. I'm an academic person, not that academic, more, but some. There's a, you know, work by these great authors like Douglas North, who studied in Ottawa. He got a Nobel Prize for studying institutions. They think institutions matter. You know, economists at MIT, Asa McLuhan Robinson, who wrote this book, Why Nations Fail. And they said unequivocally, after this broad sweep of history, they fail when governments or when parliaments cannot hold the executive to account. Then another great little book written by The Great Degeneration, How Institutions Decay and Economies Die, written by another historian, Niall Ferguson, very popular person. So, you know, we ignore all this at our peril, I would argue. Just a few words about the role of a legislative budget office. So again, it starts out, it's all about that power of the purse. Where do you want the power of the purse? Yes, we want the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister to table budgets, and they're going to table an economic and fiscal update in a few weeks, and there'll be a budget probably in February, and put forward their policy agendas. We want that. But we also want, under our Constitution and our Financial Administration Act, it says that the power of the purse rests with the individual MPs. So they need to have that information. They need to do their jobs. So all the money that you contribute to your taxes, it goes into a pot. And before it comes taken out of that pot, individual MPs like Mr. Ray, they have to approve, you know, those spending appropriations. They have to approve those changes to tax legislation or the new programs for the criminal justice system. And that's the way our system works. So they need information. What kind of information do they need? Well, I have a sense. I just have this feeling. I've been, you know, working for the finance department for 27 years, working for prime ministers in the Privy Council office and the Treasury, that it's what we call decision support information. Like, what did you base that decision on? So if you're, again, we're going to talk briefly about the criminal justice system when you change laws. Like, what are the costs of those things? That's decision support. All MPs should have that information. That's not cabinet confidence. That's just adding and subtracting numbers, you know, what these costs would be. And let our political leaders talk about the bigger issues, the priorities. Is this the priority for the country? Are there policy trade-offs? Do we spend money this way or that way? But let's give them all that information they need to know how we're spending your money, which is basically the way I approach the job. So PBO, the Parliamentary Budget Office, was set on, up under the Accountability Act. So we was, you know, basically the genesis was, after many years, people were frustrated with projections. Like, we just had a projection on the deficit, or we had a projections. We had a recent report on the deficit, and the deficit came in a bit lower, about $7 billion lower than what the government said in the budget. And, you know, and if you miss your targets by a lot, it could actually have an impact on public policy. If you're off by tens and 20 billions of dollars. So they said, wouldn't it be nice, and I joke about this, if you had a bald-headed person like me, that can actually add and subtract and give Parliament additional information so they can debate, you know, it's okay, we have this money, we don't have this money, we have this flexibility, we could spend more money here or there. So help give parliamentarians like Mr. Bob Rae, you know, additional information on projections. Then they said, wouldn't it be nice as well, besides, you know, on costing fighter planes or changes to old age security, if you had additional data points, somebody else that said, well, this is our independent costing, and throw that in the mix so somebody like Mr. Rae as well could say, okay, so Parliamentary Budget Office says this, the government says this, and if we have a big discrepancy, then we need to have a debate, whether this is, you know, around the numbers and then around the priorities. And if the numbers are the same, they move quickly on. And then about the estimates. Like, every year, like, all these departments, and we have, like, food inspection agencies and human resource and social development departments, you know, the Correctional Services Canada, they come in and they provide these big books, and they're supposed to be voted on. Wouldn't it be nice if we had somebody helping MPs like Mr. Rae scrutinize that spending on foreign affairs? Is it spending effectively? Is it efficient? So then we started doing the job. And we said, okay, you know, we said, in, for example, in 2008, a week before Minister Flaherty released his economic and fiscal update, Canada's headed for a recession, we're headed for deficits. And, you know, Minister Flaherty at the time said, no recession, no deficit. And as I've said before, a week or two after that, we got our budget cut by a third. So then we said, like, on costing fighter planes, like, you know, you say it's $16 billion for life cycle costs. We think it's $30 billion. And then we got blasted for a week. Or on crime bills, where the government says, we're not giving you any information. And we're saying, well, actually, that's not right. Like, this is systemic failure of the system. And we would put out numbers I'm going to talk about very briefly. Or on austerity in the 2012 budget, when the government said, now we have a majority government. Now we're freezing, you know, discretionary spending in departments. And we said, as the budget office says, well, we need to see the spending plans because we need to assess risk for parliamentarians. And they said, you know, you're not seeing the plans. There's no accountability in that scenario. So they gave us this broad mandate. At the same time, they gave us very weak legislation on appointment. I was appointed by the prime minister. Does it really make sense? Does anybody in this room that the Parliamentary Budget Officer only be appointed by the prime minister? You know, I was, in terms of tenure, I work at pleasure. Does it make sense when you're providing an analysis to Parliament, to Canadians, that could be confrontational with the government and the public service, that you can be dismissed at any time, you know, without dismissal by cause? And then they put me in the Library of Parliament, which is a great institution, but not somebody that does the kind of work that we've done in the past 5 years. So it was created this congruency issues. So for me, the whole PBO thing, it was an experiment. Nobody wanted the job. I didn't want it. Nobody wanted because the legislation, first off, was very weak. Again, that whole idea of being appointed by the person you're supposed to watch, working at pleasure, as opposed to being dismissed by cause. And most importantly, this is culture of secrecy that has pervaded not just the government, but I would say the public service. They stopped showing their work. There was a time under Liberal governments and under Conservative governments, and I would say even Conservative governments did not sound partisan, where I worked at finance during the 80s, and we did free trade, and we did changes to the goods and services tax, and we published all kinds of, you know, cost estimates and policy impact studies. None of this was happening. So why take a job in this environment? I took it because a few of my friends said, we had to do this. And they encouraged me to take the job. And I just felt at a certain point in my career that it was a very small price to pay. And then the deal with my colleagues was that came to this office that Mr. Ray spoke about that are the real talent, you know, of the team. They said, let's build something that just looks really 21st century. Even if Parliament looks a bit ancient right now, not ancient because the principles are ancient, but the principles are good, but just like not functioning well. Let's build something that's lean. At the peak of our height of our office, we're 12 people with a couple of students, all in, including myself. And let's build something that's completely open and transparent. Let's just publish everything we do. Every single thing that we do gets put up on our website. Every time we ask for information from a deputy, like a deputy or a commissioner of the Correctional Services Canada, let's publish it. And he comes back and says, we can't give you that information, let's publish that. Everything. Let's do something that's analytical. Like the back end of our work, whether it's costing fighter planes or crime bills or fiscal sustainability studies on pension systems, that academics could look at it and say, well, you know, test, kick our tires. And let's put our names on it. And let's put an executive summary on that that everybody can understand. And more importantly, if somebody calls, if Dan calls, you show up. You know, if the Public Accounts Committee calls, we gladly show up. If the House of Finance Committee shows up, we call. If the media calls, in English or French, their office, you pick up. Everybody picks up in their office. Is that just something completely open? Because guess what? We work for Canadians. Parliament works for Canadians. So they see everything we got. The lesson I learned was that change is very difficult. And there was lots of friction. Like, you know, with public servants, which was, you know, we weren't naive about, and with the government, if our information was different. But as a former boss said, Kevin, there's no risk-free risk. Like, you can't say you're going to live in a riskless environment and then you're going to move the yardsticks forward on big issues. So for us, we always kind of thought, like, this experiment was potentially doomed. That we're going to end up at this point where, after 5 years, if we're lucky enough the last 5 years, that the office was going to be unwound. So the point was, can we get the bar as high as we can? So it's just some things on PBO costing in the criminal justice system. Again, we're not experts. Like, there's no experts. We weren't experts on F-35. We weren't experts on pensions. We weren't experts on, like, G8, G20 security. We weren't experts on Aboriginal educational infrastructure. You know, so what we were experts at, or not experts, but our mindset was, we'll find experts. We'll take our toolbox, as economists and as financial analysts, and we'll go sit down with the experts on all those issues, including the criminal justice system. And if we went to the Correctional Services, Canada, and we said, listen, we're costing this bill or that bill, and I'll provide a few numbers on those bills, if they said, sorry, we can't help you, it's not in our interest, we just said, fine, we'll go find somebody that does find it's in their interest. So we would just take our toolbox and we'll go to the provinces. And, as we're going to talk about some of the numbers, the provinces have a lot of experience in this business. So there were always people that were willing to find and we could talk to. That was just a mindset that people brought to the office, not me, but really, in many cases, the other people in the office. So we did three pieces of work over 5 years on the criminal justice system. One was the funding requirement and the impact on the Truth in Sentencing Act on the correctional system in Canada. We did that in the summer of 2010. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. It's changing the remand system. The other one was we looked at the fiscal impact of changes in eligibility for conditional sentences in Canada. So you change conditional sentences, you make them less, make them, we use them with less frequency. What is the impact of that? And lastly, and this was more my idea, that it just out of frustration from the first two projects, we said we needed to sit down and just build a framework for this cost of the criminal justice system. How big is the system? Like, how big is the security aspects? How big are the court aspects? How big is the correctional services part? And, just trying to piece together all the different data from the different levels. It's a complicated system. And that was really more just because, like, we started out, we didn't feel like we had a good enough foundation when we were doing this work. When we did all this work, I need to be honest, we were completely, and we're trained to be agnostic on policy. Like, it was never in our mindset that, we needed to, when we were costing this thing, that we would, we took a policy position on it, because that would have made us partisan. Are you supportive of the government or non-supportive of the government? For us, it was just like, how do these numbers add up? You change the laws. What can we say to parliamentarians that sounds authoritative, that they can use in debate and they can use for accountability purposes? That's not to mean to say that you don't have policy feelings on all these issues. Like, you know, we all do. Like, I think we all have some ideology or some sort of sense of what is right and wrong. But I think in our cases, we were just like, we needed to look at it from the point of view of the calculator. So some facts and some figures now. So total government spending on the criminal justice system, what did we find? That includes security. You know, it's all the policing at the different levels of government, federal levels, provincial levels, municipal levels. That includes the courts, provincial levels, you know, and the federal courts. And that includes corrections. What do we find? We find if you add all that up, you get to a little over $20 billion. $20 billion, $20.3 billion, 2011 and 12 when we did this. That's nationally. You know, about 75% of that $20 billion is provincial. So it's basically, it's managed at the provincial level. That's about a little under $15 billion. About 25% is federal, and that's about a little over $5 billion. So $20 billion. So is that a lot of money, $20 billion? Not $20 million, but $20 billion. That, for every person in this room, that's $582 every year out of your, you know, that's just to give you a sense, 580, everybody kicks in 582 for this system. That's what that feels like right across the country. That's about the same amount of money we spend on national defense. So all those discussions on fighter planes and on ships and the boots on the ground that we had in Afghanistan, the people that we have the, you know, across the country, the good soldiers that do the work, they spend roughly the same as we spend on our criminal justice system. It's about 10% of what we spend on health care in this country. So if you add up all the health care, the public and the private, you get upwards of $200 billion. We're spending $20 billion on the criminal justice system. It's about a quarter of what we spend publicly on education. You know, so if you think about the public expenditures in education, the kids, you know, for people, it's about a quarter of that spending on that system. It's about 1 percentage point of our gross domestic product. You know, every year, the value added of all the goods and services that I produce, when I've met people from different businesses, DuPont, other places, you know, the, you know, retail services, all that is, we'd be about 1% of that. In absolute terms, that's a lot of money. That's just a big number in absolute terms. Does it feel unreasonable in relative terms? This is a normative question. This is where you hand it over and you say to Mr. Ray, who would have been a great prime minister, you would have say, is that the amount, the right size that you want for the criminal justice system? Do you want to spend more or less? You know, budget people call it allocative efficiency. Is that the right amount? And you could benchmark it against what other countries are spending. As Mr. Ray said, they spend a lot more per capita in the United States, certainly in some number of states. Okay, how is this money spent? About 60% of that money, that $20 billion, is just for security. That's policing at the different levels of government. So roughly almost $10 billion provincial, roughly $2 billion of that is federal, RCMP. My brother's an RCMP officer. About 20% of it is in the courts. You know, so and roughly out of that 20%, roughly $3 billion is provincial, and about $1 billion is federal. So again, you allocate that out, 20% courts, 60% security. And about 20% is corrections, just a little less than $3 billion federal, about $2 billion in terms of corrections, the incarceration side of it. So bottom lines, it's mostly provincial, and it's heavily weighted to security. Okay, what is happening to spending trends in the criminal justice system? What's happening? Is spending staying the same? Is it going up? Is it going down? Remember, I said $582 per person. That seems kind of real. People get that. So if you look at, you take away inflation, and you look at per capita spending, it's going up over the past 10 years. Spending is going up on that system. It's growing up after inflation, so greater than inflation. It's going up while the crime rate is going down. So we're spending more in this system, but the crime rate is going down. That usually gets economists when they see these lines going this way and line going, we get all excited about that stuff. So real per capita spending has gone up about $100. So you've added, for you go through your 2002 budget, remember I said roughly $582, to about 2012, you're spending an extra $100 every year out of your pocket for this criminal justice system. Meanwhile, the crime rate has fallen. Like if you look at, you know, Statistics Canada all-in incidences, back in 2002 we had 8,000 incidences of crime for 100,000 people. So 8,000 for roughly 100,000. And now we're down to under 6,000. 100,000. So what is driving that upward increase, that extra $100, you know, over the past 10 years? What's driving it is mostly additional policing costs right now and some additional court costs, but mostly policing costs. So just a few bottom lines. It's an expensive system. $20 billion is a lot of money. You know, for a budget person, that's materiality. It's a system where the federal government can change the criminal code, which impacts everybody across the system. So they change it in Ottawa, and it impacts all across, you know, from coast to coast to coast. It's a system that's largely provincial in weight. Like when you add it, like the policing side, that's the meat of it, right? 60% is policing. It's very much in the, so federalism, cooperation needs to be, is very important in this world. It's a system that is experiencing increases in spending while your objective, the crime rate, is going down. So that's when you want to involve people like criminologists and other, you know, smart people that are in this room saying, okay, what's driving it? Is there a connectivity? Are we spending more on policing? Is that what's bringing down the incidences? Or is the fact that Kevin Page is getting older and I just feel less inclined to commit crime? Or other factors, you know, just other factors. So just to tell you, like, we had to put together this information. You couldn't go to Statistics Canada and say, what's the cost of the criminal justice system? We had to build this information, working with our good colleagues at Statistics Canada, to put all these pieces together. We actually had to survey provinces, and we didn't get all the information for the small provinces, so we had to make a bunch of assumptions. And I say all this because in 2006, the government launched a major platform on tough on crime. We're going to be tough on crime. And they had no sense of what the system looked like. And they had no sense of what the costs were going, or where they're going up, or whether they're going down. They didn't have these sort of big component pieces, but they launched because it felt right. So, notwithstanding the evidence, so some crime bill costing. Just some words on the two big crime bills that we looked at. One is very material in terms of dollars and cents. Both are important. So we looked at truth in sentencing. You know, that's the remand system. So people get 2 days credit for 1 day served before being convicted and sentenced and incarcerated. And this was like in the fall of 2009. We're the Parliamentary Budget Officers. 1 year in, my budget's been cut by a third because of my projections and costing of a war. They didn't like me. And then we said, you know, this is in front of, you know, I remember the Minister of Justice and the Minister of Public Safety saying, we're now introducing the Truth in Sentencing Act. And he said, it's in front of Parliament. And then, you know, some of the media people were going in, and some of the MPs were saying, well, what's the cost of this? Like, this is a big change to the system. Like, you know, because it's just in sheer numbers, it's got to be huge. And they said, well, we can't give you those numbers. That's a cabinet confidence. And, you know, then more pressing, and then I heard, you know, their quotes, which we were tracking quite carefully at this time, they were saying, well, can't give you the numbers because they're just hard to estimate. And still, again, we have this legislation in front of MPs. It's a very big change to our criminal code. And they're saying, cabinet confidence, these numbers, why do you care? Don't bother. They're hard to estimate. Why worry about it? We need to be tough on crime. And, for us, sitting back at the Parliamentary Budget Office, we're sitting around. We have no expertise in this area. We just had our budget cut. We're looking at this thing saying, we got to do this. Like, this is systemic failure of our system. New legislation, you know, Magna Carta, power of the purse, information in front of Parliament, and basically the executive saying, I'm not giving you anything. Just vote on it anyways. And then they would use, you know, the pressure tactics of being tough on crime to kind of win the day. So we got the request. Actually, this request came from a member of Parliament from Ajax Pickering, and we didn't turn it down. So basically, we did two types of analysis. And like in our office, we always just, before you put something in front of parliamentarians, you give something to Mr. Ray, you do kind of one model, then we call it like the Warren Buffett back of the envelope test, the reasonableness model, just to make sure, does this make sense? Like, as we come up with these numbers, like fighter plans, sometimes they seem really big, or even crime costing seems big. So you build a model and you kind of work with people in the provinces, you know, people in universities, and then you say, okay, let's look at it. So we did one model, which is forward looking. You know, what happens to costs over the next 5 years? Then another model, we said, well, what if we introduced this legislation like a few years ago, where we actually have real data? And we just, you know, what would it look like? What would be the impact on the ground? I'll just talk about that latter one. So first, a couple of key parameters, a sense of the expense of incarceration. And there's experts in this room I already know that know this stuff a million times better than anybody in my office. But in 2007 and 2008, funding per cell, so, one, you know, funding per cell, of, you know, this could be one person or more than one person. in terms of operating and maintenance, keeping it running, in terms of capital appropriation, was about $145,000 per inmate. $145,000 to keep somebody in a cell. This is like not PBO. This is numbers anybody can basically get from just adding and subtracting, doing a ratio from public documents. And this compares to about $40,000 in a, you know, if you put somebody on parole that's in a very different type of environment. So $145,000, this is an expensive system. You know, estimates by the commissioner of the correctional services indicated the cost of building a new cell. Again, it's not PBO's numbers. This is their numbers, which we used in our estimates. Just the cost of building a cell. I find this amazing because I might finally be moving, you know, and we're looking at a new house. And I don't know if this helps me buying a new house or not, but, you know, for a low-security cell, the cost of building a new cell, again, if you put more people in these systems, you have to build new cells. And we had all these rules about incarceration, how many people per cell and stuff like that. But one cell, a low-security cell, $260,000 for a low-security cell. That's an expensive business, $260,000. Again, this isn't PBO making up the numbers. I can go, we went right back to letters from the Commissioner of Correctional Services Canada. Now, if you want a high-security cell, and that's $600,000. Like, holy smokes, how many people can even afford, you know, to live in a $600,000 house or a $600,000 condominium? But a $600,000 cell, this is a very expensive business, incarceration. Then it's the whole issue whether it works or not. So bottom lines for the Truth in Sentencing Act, changing remand, 2007 and 8. What if we had this system in 2007 and 8, not 5 years hence? Federally, we easily can calculate longer stays of about 160 days. So each of these people, would they lose their remand, they'd be staying an extra, on average, 160 days. These people would be piling up in the system. You're talking about an extra 3,700 people in the system, in the federal penitentiary system. You know, they have, at this time, about 8,500 people in the system. So you're adding another 3,700 people, like, in terms of in the system during the course of the year. That's like $600 million a year in terms of additional operating and maintenance and additional capital. That's a lot of money. You know, again, that's a lot of money. That doesn't include new construction costs. You know, because if you have to make a choice whether you want to put more people in these cells or you want to keep one per cell. Again, it's a lot of money, and nothing was provided to Parliament. They said, just go vote. He says, you don't need to know about this stuff to the individual MPs. Nothing showed up in Correctional Services Canada report on plans and priorities for this new initiative, the Truth in Sentencing Act. You can go to those documents. We've been to them many times. Nothing in those documents. And then for me, as somebody who worked on many budgets, nothing ever showed up in a federal budget on this initiative. You can't go back to the 2009, 10, 11, 12 budget and say, Truth in Sentencing Act, we're changing this system. And yet we're probably talking about something in addition of $500 million per year. Federally, and again, provincially, the impact is even bigger than $500 million a year because they carry that. You know, we're 25% of the system. There's 75% of the system. Like I found, to us, that was amazing. And we put that analysis out. And then after we put it out, you know, the Commissioner of the Correctional Services Canada said, we're put it out a number that's almost similar for us, which is about $2 billion over the next 5 years. And that still didn't show up in the budget. Never showed up even in their reports. It showed up in a press release. Again, somebody like me that was working on a spreadsheet for decades, almost three decades, working at, you know, finance and treasury and PCO, like we would make sure every time a new government came in with a Speech from the Throne initiative and they launched this new program, and we changed the bottom line. We adjusted the bottom line. You had to do that. Like, you know, to not do that, I don't even know what, I wouldn't want to come up with an appropriate word for that. But you are creating major problems for future finance ministers and future governments if you bury this stuff. You know, and there's ways to bury, but it's never a right thing. So then we looked at restrictions to conditional sentencing. Again, no cost estimates. This is the big omnibus C-10. No estimates in the budget, no estimates in Correctional Services Canada's, you know, it's 3-year projections going out. PBO analysis, you know, looked at the law. What if it was in place in 2008-09? And so we did the analysis. So again, we're taking away, you know, the ability to put people on conditional sentencing, and you can go through, you know, the dozens of various, you know, things that would be no longer available. And we worked with, you know, Statistics Canada, people, the justice statistics. You'd be, you know, the impact of it was about 4,500 people would be impacted by that. So, you know, we would, some, in many cases, these people either would have been let go, or perhaps through a trial, or they would actually be incarcerated now. So for these people, that would increase the cost from about $3,000 to about $40,000 per person, which is the kind of a parole type of cost, with a total bill of about $8 million a year. So not as significant as changing the Truth in Sentencing Act, but that's just the federal level, about $8 million a year. But again, nothing provided by the federal government what this would cost. And again, the provincial impact was like more than 10 times bigger than that number. And again, nothing provided to the provinces as well and what their costs would be. Which always astounded us because we went to the provinces right away back in the Truth in Sentencing Act and we said, well, what is your cost estimates? They said, well, we never did anything. I said, this is going to hit you really hard. And they said, well, we haven't done the analysis. And that struck us as odd. I don't think federalism is in good shape, and we have an expert in federalism right here. So in conclusion, so what happens when the government moves forward a new policy and provides no decision support information, including costing and information? What happens? Number one, policy debate is stifled. It's a big difference when you say something is free. You tell people like you can put more people in prisons and you can keep them there longer and there's no cost. Versus, well, there is a cost. And then when you start looking at the cost, and there are hundreds of millions of dollars a year, then as my father-in-law says, and we weren't able to do that analysis, what if we did something else? He says, Kevin, what if we build better community centers in Aboriginal communities where Mr. Way is working and he's dealing with these amazing drug issues? What if we build better health centers? Like, wouldn't we get big? This is my father-in-law saying this from Thunder Bay. Like, what if we just did this? Can't you do that analysis? But again, we never had that debate because the government's basically saying, we can put people in prisons, we can keep them there longer, and there's no cost. There's nothing to debate. Like, this is, you got to sign on this dotted line. It's a great deal. It's like buying the proverbial waterfront property in Florida. Number two, Parliament is not given information required to hold the government to account. Parliament loses control of the public purse. And to me, that's all the way back to William Gladstone. That starts to affect trust. What are you guys doing? What are you doing in Ottawa? Like, we send you there, MPs from my hometown, Thunder Bay, to Ottawa. Like, you should be scrutinizing the spending. You're not doing that. This stuff is going through. You're not doing your job. I'm losing confidence in you. Never mind the Senate, as we hear it, watch it today. That's a fundamental problem. There's nothing to hold them to account. Number three, you plant these seeds for future fiscal problems. That's what happens. Like, I started Department of Finance in 1980. We ran deficits after deficits after deficits, and they were what we call structural. Then it blew up in our face in the mid-1990s. Major fiscal crisis, debt to GDP, federally almost 70%, provincially 100%. Even the credit rating agency saying we're considering downgrading Canada. At that point, and then we had to cut transfers to provinces, healthcare transfers. We had to cut educational transfers to provinces, social transfers to provinces, and we to deal with this fiscal problem. And this is what happens. It could be fighter planes, but it could be crime bills as well. It could be other stuff. When you make these decisions, you bury the stuff below the line, say it's not going to cost anything. And then all of a sudden, some finance minister wakes up, and he has a big problem. And again, lastly, the whole trust, the quality of our democracy declines. So it's a big problem. But for me, this is fixable. If we really wanted to fix it, we could fix it. You know, people, we could design an appropriation system where, you know, this information is just, it's automatically released. This system already exists in other countries. Like in New Zealand, and where they automatically, people like me for decades, we would do this financial analysis, and it gets attached to a cabinet, a cabinet discussion, and where it's just obviously confidential, but the financial work just gets released. So it could be crime bills, it could be changes to old age security, fighter planes. Here's our analysis. And it gets released in other countries. And so like that fundamentally would change everything. This bringing this new level of transparency. Earlier, last week, I was at Ryerson at an event with a former deputy chief of staff from the Conservative Party. We were on a panel talking about corporate and public sector governance, the public good. And his view was, this was Keith Beardsley, he says, it's going to happen. It's going to be a rough process to get there, but it's going to happen. And he said, when he joked about it, he said, Kevin, yeah, it's true, we cut your budget by a third. You should be happy because we were planning on cutting by a half. But it was that kind of mindset. He said, either way, the next generation is going to watch it. It's going to want it. They're going to want this information. And we were talking about social media and just the need for transparency. But then what is the handoff to the next generation? And I look at this room. Are we handing off good institutions? I'm worried about that. And second, this issue of the parliamentary budget officer. it's not a solution. It's a support that can help somebody like Parliament provide this additional data point. But again, if we want something like that, you know, we could actually, it's very easy to fix it. We can create better legislation. In the last month, I've been in the Slovak Republic, I've been in South Korea. Last month, and I also was a witness over the Ontario Committee when they set it up. I was in South Africa in the spring. They're all setting up these offices, and they're setting them up with much better legislation than Canada. See, if we want this type of information just readily available, it's easy to do. Everybody else is doing it now while we're unwinding our office effectively in Canada. So we could fix these things. So when do we fix them? I think the conversation's got to start now, and it's got to be there on these 2015 election platforms. Thank you very much.